This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. This episode is a live recording from the Write Around the Murray Festival on September 17th, 2023. Kate speaks to authors Irma Gold, Catherine Heyman and Tim Napper about their first and subsequent publishing experiences and what they've learned along the way.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the final day of Write Around the Murray. I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri elders, traditional custodians of this land. The Wurundjeri people have been looking after this place for thousands of years. This is stolen land. It is Aboriginal land. Always was and always will be. At this point in time too, as we approach the referendum and as part of Writers for the Voice, I'd just like to add my support for the Uluru Statement for the Heart and a yes vote. My name is Kate Mildenhall. I am one half of the First Time Podcast, which you may or may not have heard. I co-host that with writer Catherine Collette. And today's panel is going to be broadcast on the podcast. So do note, you will have time for questions. Make your question good, because it will be forever recorded in our archive. I've had the pleasure of interviewing over 300 authors for the podcast, and I'm so excited to be able to talk to these three. We could, in fact, go for 3 hours. We only have an hour and 10, so it's going to be fast and furious. My third novel, The Hummingbird Effect, was recently released, and I'll be talking to Paul Delgano about that this afternoon. To my panel, please note that we have organised to be sitting on the chairs that most pop with our outfits. Mm. So if you can just make sure you take all the pictures and take note of that. Directly beside me here is Catherine Heyman. Catherine is the author of 6 novels, including Storm and Grace and Captain Starlight's Apprentice, which was serialised, I didn't know this, on BBC Radio to an audience of 2 million. And was published last year in a new edition. Her previous work has won so many things: the Wingate, Southern Arts and Arts Council of England Writing Awards in the UK, and been nominated for awards including the Scottish Writer of the Year, the Orange Prize, the Edinburgh Fringe Critics Award, the Kibble Prize, and the West Australian Premier's Literary Awards. Alongside her publishing career, she was for several years a frequent dramatist for stage and for BBC Radio. Catherine won the Cal Author Fellowship for her 2021 memoir, Fury, which is up here and which I highly recommend you purchase a copy of today, which was one of the Guardian's 25 best books of the year. Furia was nominated for the International Folio Prize, shortlisted for the Adelaide Festival Awards for Literature, and is in development as a feature film, which is very exciting. Catherine taught poetry and writing for the University of Oxford and is now the director of the Australian Writers Mentoring Program, which we'll get to talking about too. Next to her is Irma Gold, who you may have seen last night doing a fabulous performance for Stereo Stories. Irma is a writer and full-time freelance book editor based in Nam. Her debut novel, The Breaking, won the Writing New South Wales Varuna Fellowship and a Canberra Critics Circle Award and was shortlisted for the ACT Notable Award for Fiction. Her short fiction has been widely published in literary journals, and a critically acclaimed collection of short stories is 2 Steps Forward, and she doesn't like the title, but we might get to that later. She is also the author of 5 children's picture books, including Where the Heart Is and Cerise Story, again, both available out there in the bookshop, and is co-host of the writing podcast Secrets from the Green Room with writer Karen Biggers. T.R. Napper. Tim, over on the end there, is the multi-award winning speculative fiction author. His short fiction has appeared in annual Year's Best anthologies and he's been published in respected genre magazines in the US, the UK, Israel, Austria, Australia, Singapore and Vietnam. Before turning to writing, Tim was a diplomat and an aid worker, delivering humanitarian programs in Southeast Asia. During this period, he resided in the Old Quarter in Hanoi, the setting for his debut novel, 36 Streets, again available in the bookshop. Naffer earned his doctorate in creative writing for his thesis on noir, cyberpunk and Asian modernity. These days he's returned to his home country of Australia where, in addition to writing, he works as a dungeon master, running campaigns for young people with autism for a local charity. Please welcome our guests. I have so many questions, as I said, for these three. Between them, they have a wealth of knowledge in all aspects of the industry. As I said, there'll be time for audience Q&A, but I want to start where we always start on the podcast, which is to ask you if you remember the first time you saw your words in print, maybe in a school newspaper, perhaps something you made for your friends. What was it, and when did you catch the writing bug? And Catherine, you're next to me, so I'm going to start with you.
Okay. It's not in print, but when I was in primary school, I had a little business going, writing poems about the teachers and my schoolmates.
Nice
and,
poems?
And, funny poems, right. And sometimes nice. but it was definitely a moment of feeling like this is something I can do and I like doing it. And people will pay for it.
I love it.
I mean, I think the going rate was like 15 cents or a bag of lollies or something, you know, but it definitely gave me a sort of a thrill, possibly one that was never to be repeated. That was my height.
I love that. Irma, what about you?
I think the first was in a school magazine, but it wasn't the actual seeing the words on the page that was the big thing for me. It was what actually happened before that and why I wrote the story, because I think I was about 16 at the time. One of my really dear friends, her mother had died, and she was very angry. She was angry at the adults around her. Nobody understood what she was going through, and I didn't have any experience of that. I didn't have any way of kind of supporting her. And I wrote this short story about a girl and her grandmother. I made it a grandmother, not a mother, but gave her all of the emotions that I saw in my friend. And when I gave her this story to read, she cried. Mm. And she said, "That is exactly how I feel." And it was like it really validated her and her experience. And that was just like this kind of amazing moment for me where I was like, oh my God, I was able to put myself in someone else's shoes and write about something I've not ever experienced, and that to feel authentic. Mm. And I think looking back, that was actually the moment when I kind of realised that was something I really wanted to do, and that's kind of continued for me. It's really about writing from what I know into what I don't know and seeking those kind of experiences of things that aren't actually my experience. That's what I find most interesting. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it wasn't really the words on the page. It was actually the response that I got from that one reader.
That can be addictive too, can't it? That idea of your capacity to make someone feel something really big is often what draws us on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tim, what about you?
Oh, I think I'm a bit of a late bloomer with these things. I can't recall having anything published in primary school or high school. The first thing I remember having my name on was when... This is a bit bizarre, but I was working in Mongolia as a volunteer in my 20s. And I was working for a government department that dealt with child poverty and so forth. But I decided to take a second job with I wrote a fake article about cricket for the Ulaanbaatar Post. So
early fake news tip.
Well, not fake, but fake in the sense where expatriates would play cricket on an abandoned baseball field. The Americans had built the Mongolians a baseball stadium, and the Mongolians aren't going to use it, so it was just left abandoned. So we'd play cricket on there, all the Indian and Australian and English expats. And so I wrote it up as though it was a real professional cricket match. And the openers strode out into the field, and the weather was like this, and blah blah. And I sent it to the Ulaanbaatar Post, and they published it.
Oh, I love that.
And then they asked me to keep doing it, so I became a cricket columnist in Mongolia for the Ulaanbaatar Post. And it's like an 8-page newspaper, and they came out once a week, and half the back page was cricket. And I had a name. What was my name? It was not Richie Benner, it was Ben Ritchie.
I wrote it. I love it. very important.
So it started as a joke, but then it was also awesome at the same time. And people would get angry at me if I didn't report it properly.
I think what's lovely about those three stories and what we hear on the podcast all the time is that first addiction to getting a response from a reader, and that is often what draws a writer all the way through.
I just, as you were talking, Emma, when you were talking about that first reader, I was thinking, I was so convinced that therefore everyone would want my story.
Yes.
Then I would write these sort of stories. The only access to literature we had in my very working class home was Women's Weekly and New Idea. So I would write these little stories or columns and go off every week and post them with the full expectation that they would be published and I would be paid. I was utterly convinced and astonished.
Yeah.
That why everyone, like, these are connecting.
Yeah.
You know,
people want my work. Yes. And that is why it is
tragedy.
So often, yeah, the tragedy of when you do ship the work out for the first time, thinking that you're going to get a publishing deal and it doesn't necessarily come. And this is what our listeners on the First Time podcast are addicted to hearing. How did you get your big break? So I want to ask Tim, you said in a great blog post, and I'll quote, "I think luck plays a part. In general, you have to be good and lucky in publishing. Right publisher, right editor, right time, and dogged persistence almost certainly plays a part." Mm. So I want to ask, how did you get your first break into publishing?
Yeah, it's not a happy story. Well, I guess it's happy in the end because the book's there, so I must have a happy ending, I suppose. But I had a UK agent, a London-based agent, and when you write in science fiction and fantasy, in general, although Kate's showed me there might be another way. But in general, if you're an Australian writing in science fiction and fantasy, your audience is going to be overseas. So if you... The market here in Australia for crime and literary fiction and so forth is a lot bigger, but for sci-fi fantasy is pretty small. So in my mind, I'm like, I have to get an agent in either the US or the UK. So I got a UK agent. And we had one novel that he was trying to sell and he couldn't sell it, and he was really, had been really gung-ho about, and he's like, it's going to go to auction, this, that, and nothing happened. So that ended up being trunked. And then I gave him 36 Streets, and he wrote this long and borderline abusive email back saying how much he hated the book. And it was very upsetting. I put it in my blog post, but I always remember the last sentence of the email, which was, he's a very posh English bloke, was, "And whatever led you to believe, Tim, that anyone would wish to waste 10 hours of their life reading your book?" You know, that was like a punch in the stomach. And I was shell-shocked. And I saw this guy as my ticket to a career. And so I really struggled with what to do, but in the end, I did the only thing you really could do, and I dumped his ass, you know.
Yeah.
And I sent the book out again, and it's so hard getting an agent. Oh, my God, and it takes so long. You have to write these bloody... You've got to conform to all their different expectations on the cover letter, and then you've got to pitch your book. And so I went through that whole process again, got another agent. He loved the book. Again, in the UK, another English agent. This is a long story. I'll try and cut it short. Everyone rejected it. Or nearly everyone except for it was 18 months, out for 18 months, which is a long time for a book to be out. And the very last publisher, Titan UK, said yes. And then it's done great since. You know, it earned out. It's got a lot of... It won awards. All for a book that was derided by my agent and rejected by everyone. So it's such a... That's why I say in that article, it's luck's a part.
Yeah.
And dogged persistence,
yeah,
I think, is absolutely a part, because I could have given up just a little bit earlier and I wouldn't be here now, you know?
And this is what we always talk about too. You only need one. You only need one publisher to love it. I mean, it's great if everyone loves it, but really, in the end, you only need,
you need
that one.
You need if you can find a champion in publishing, in short fiction and for novels, if you can find that champion for your work, which I think I might have now, then you can breathe a little easier, I suppose, but finding one, bloody hell,
yeah,
it's hard.
Emma, you publish in a wide array of forms. You've got your debut novel, The Breaking, but you've also got picture books and your collection of short stories. What came first and how did you get that deal?
Yeah, I don't have like a big story like that because I started out writing short stories and publishing those. And then I think my first book that was published was actually a children's book. And so I think some people think that I was a children's author who moved into adult fiction. I mean, that sounds very 50 Shades of Grey. I don't quite say that. But whereas I actually saw moving into children's books as kind of a tangent.
Yes.
And that my adult work, well, now I sound like a porn star, let me call it literary fiction.
Yes.
But literary fiction was actually where I started. And so there was a kind of a progression from publishing individual short stories to publishing a short fiction collection to publishing a novel. Meanwhile, I'm also publishing children's books as well. Mm. But so there was this kind of, oh, it still is, I think, for some people, an idea that I move from children's books into literary fiction, which isn't the case. But for me, it's just kind of built, I suppose, over time. The story amount around my short fiction collection was kind of cool, but I've already told that on this podcast, so I'm not going to tell it again. but yeah, it's just kind of built over time for me, I guess. But there's definitely luck involved always, I think. But you can't just have talent and persistence and all of those things. There's definitely a good dose of luck that you need to.
There's a bit of a key element in that story too, though, which is that you, and it's one that comes up a lot. I see this because I mentor new writers. I see this one a lot, and I've seen it with, you know, friends in writing where the debut is not the debut. Yeah. Mark Haddon's Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which is big debut, lauded as, it's not his debut by any stretch.
Yeah.
But what you did was you tried this thing. Okay, well, while that's bubbling away, I'm not going to give up on it, but I'm going to go over and try this thing. I'm going to find my voice, find my genre, find my groove. And, you know, so you're backing yourself, you're backing each project, but you continue. I'm assuming that a lot of people listening and a lot of people here are aspiring writers. Mm. So I think that's a kind of golden tip. Mm. So back to work, but keep trying new things as well.
Yeah, it's true that by the time I got to my debut novel, I'd actually already published a bunch of books. Mm. But the thing is, I didn't know if I could ever write a novel. When I was writing short stories, I was like, oh my God, I don't think I can. And I kind of tricked myself into writing The Breaking, actually, because it started out where I wrote a short story and then I took it to, I had this great short fiction group and they were like, oh, this is really great, but we want to know what happens next. And so I wrote another one thinking, I'll write a couple of linked short stories. And the same thing happened. They were like, we want to know what happens next. And I wrote a third one. And then my lovely friend, John Clancy, said, I think you might be writing a novel. And I was like, oh my God, I am. So I tricked myself. It was kind of, it wasn't this daunting sitting down to write a novel. By the time I realised I was writing a novel, I think I had like 20,000 words or something. So I was on my way.
Mm. I think short stories, that was my avenue as well. Like, I do, that's my debut novel, but I did have a collection that came out first. But short stories made me a better writer, I think. Mm. I think it's a very difficult skill to master. But also, it's that pleasure of seeing your stories out there in different forms. And even though it's a very small audience for short stories, there is a readership that starts to get into your work. And then when the novel comes along, they're like, oh, cool, I'm going to get that.
Well, and the chance, you know, we talk on the podcast a lot about my debut deal came from submitting a short story to an award, which it did not win, but my first publisher was on that panel, and thus that's, you know, the relationship. Yeah. So I say always to people, do those short stories, submit them not only for that opportunity, but because when you send something out and you perfect it and you send it out, that's often a new phase, a kind of, you're turning your craft into something else.
I think.
Yeah, and there are two things here. Again, you're talking about the audience, but the bit that comes before the audience is the writing,
yes,
right? So that thing of trying, I mean, my origin story is not too dissimilar, actually. My first novel, weirdly, also called The Breaking, but it was a billion years ago in Britain. So, you know, it's just a weird coincidence.
It is
but
a weird
similarly,
coincidence.
I'd been a playwright and an actor. So I was like, well, I'm going to be writing some things that are for performance. It's a kind of performance piece. So then it became, they're short stories that are linked that I'm going to perform. And then it was short stories that are linked. And then similarly, oh, it's a novel. You know, it's a...
And how did you get that out into the world? Because it went on to have big success. Yeah. I mean, as a debut, it was long-listed for the Orange Prize, you know, straight-up success.
Yeah, yeah. It was... It was successful in the UK. I was living in the UK, so that was my my turf. I mean, one thing I would say before I say this is that I think my response to that question is, you know, it was a very long time ago. I am a crone. Actually, I think I'm before crone. There's a bit that... There are stages. But, you know, I'm kind of crone adjacent. And so I don't know how helpful that this... You know, it's a different territory, different country. I think publishing was very different then. I mean, even at that time, people were saying, oh, the big deals have gone. That happened 10 years ago. But actually now I would say, well, you know, I'm not sure that the debut experience would be the same. But I do, again, because I walk alongside quite a lot of people who are doing that debut thing, and I think the things that are translatable from my experience that still are, I would still say, do this. One was make connections. So I had my eye on an agent at that time who was, you know, one of those British Uber agents, very, very posh, but not like your man. He was charming, just, you know, but he had everyone. He had Faye Weldon, Vikram Seth, Ian McEwan. You know, he had all the kind of big guns.
Oh, cool.
And I was like, I'd like to be on your list. and he was, you know, I was irrelevant. But I went, he was speaking at an event that I was involved in, and I just made sure I shook his hand and said, I'll be sending you something. You know, shaking in my boots. He would not remember me. He did not remember me, but it meant that when I contacted him, or actually his assistant, and said, I met Giles at, there was a reason for him to read it. And every publisher and agent I know, of which, you know, I know a... I mean, basically, I'm not very socially skilled, so the only people who tolerate me are people who work in publishing. No offence, publishing people. But, you know, most of them do say, right, if I'm more likely to read it if there is some connection, because except for Tim's agent, most people don't want to be rude.
Yeah.
You know, your agent, a different story. Mm. So that's the first thing I would say. I made a connection. And then there is luck, and there is, you know, I hadn't finished that novel, and I know that was also your story, Kate. There was luck, and then there was, you know, there were also some choices that I made that were not necessarily the best choices, actually. My agent did send that book out to auction. That was luck, and it was also having his brand. But I don't think that I chose the right publisher for that book. I think I chose... I didn't feel that I had a choice about what publisher I chose, that it was expected that I would choose the publisher who paid the most. And so that's what I did. Mm. I chose the money because it didn't occur to me that I had a choice. Mm. And now I would say to newer writers, that's not always the best choice.
Mm. So I actually curious about this. So in an auction, I don't know if this is getting too obscure for the panel, but in an auction, you can knock back the highest offer?
You can. You are. This is the thing that, as a baby writer, you know, it with an agent who was just sort of, you just stand over there and watch me just do my stuff. You know, insert action of swinging.
Yeah.
Fill in the blank. Right. So I didn't know that until years later that I realised I had a choice about that.
Oh.
Yes, you have a choice. It's your career. It's your stuff.
No,
not
I thought
your
that
agent.
Was the case, but I just must have been a lot of pressure on you just to. I understand to take the most.
But you can choose for other reasons. I suppose that's my point. That it's, you know, I like the approach that this company is taking. Mm. I like their. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself, but they are some of the things that I would say.
I think they're so important, and also why after this session, when you purchase the books and you come up and introduce yourself to the authors, that is one of the things that we say all the time on the podcast. Say your name, say who you are, get in contact. If you're on social media, get in contact that way. It is a community, and we don't have conferences in the same way that other industries get to have conferences. Like, writers' festivals are where we make connections, so that's why it's so important too.
And don't be shy about
it. And you don't know what things will lead to.
Exactly.
Connection is gold.
It's everything.
I want to talk about agents and But first, we'll do a couple of definitions. So an agent is a person who stands between you and the publisher. So not all authors have an agent. It is, I know more recently in Australia, it's been considered harder to get an agent than to get a publishing deal sometimes. I didn't have an agent for my first book. Then I got one because I got in hot water about things. And an auction, which is what everyone wants and what you'll often see in books and publishing, you know, someone went to auction, is when there's multiple publishers who are interested in your book. And that's something very often you need an agent to facilitate for you. So I want to ask about our experiences with agents. And Catherine, I might start with you because not only of your personal experience with an agent, but what you advise in the current climate through your mentoring programs as well. So what's our deal? What are we advising people about agents?
So a few things. I've had lots of different agents because I'm intolerable to work with. No, because sadly, Giles, my first agent, died, which was devastating. And so then I was another agent approached me and said, Giles was barely buried, actually. And I think I was kind of a bit bamboozled and also a bit like the teenage girl who's like, oh, he likes me, so I just have to say yes. So again, it's that thing of really remember, and I know this is so hard when you are in that moment of thinking, all I want is for this work to be in the world. It is so hard to remember you also get to say yes or no. You also get to choose. And if this person isn't right for you, you know, hold firm and choose someone else. In Australia, the publishing industry is very unusual, and a lot of publishers do take manuscripts directly. So a lot of Australian writers don't need agents. Yep. I chose, when I first came back to Australia after many, many years abroad, and this might echo some of your experience, Tim, I still had my British agent who saw Australia pretty much as an irrelevant colony and I don't want to get too technical here, but I sold for most of my career, I sold into Britain first, and Australia was, you know, a kind of territory, a sub-territory. So she didn't want to, what's called, split my rights. I was saying, I'm going to live in Australia, I want to have a separate publishing deal there, and I want a separate publishing deal in the UK. British publishers don't like to give that up because they see Australia as being quite rich pickings. I mean, it's just the same old story as, you know, nothing's changed. So eventually I did change agents, and now I have an agent who is fantastic called Catherine Drayton with Inkwell, who are in the States. But Catherine is sort of Australian-American, so she, I feel like I get the terrier, but also she kind of gets the Australian thing. So my advice to writers I work with is always to, firstly, write the good book. Yep. I know I keep coming back to that, but I meet so many people who are kind of obsessed with being a writer and not obsessed with writing. Write the good book, and then you are in a much stronger position, especially for your first book. And then really think about, what do you want? What, you know, do you want an agent who's going to you know, edit you? And some agents do that, some don't. Do you want an agent who's your mate? Do you want an agent who's going to be a terrier? So I'd say always begin with really getting clear about what you want. But I don't advise the people I work with to get agents or not. If you want to publish internationally, you will need an agent. That's the one thing I'd say. And if you want to, you know, if you want to have someone else be the bad guy, you will benefit from having an agent. But if you're publishing with, you know, the spectacular Aviva Tuffield, who signed Kate's first book and always says, I know this because I had her doing an event for me recently, and she said she felt so lucky to come across you and your work. You know, if you find someone like that, then you let them be your champion. It's not obligatory. And you pay them. You pay them, they do, you know,
15%. They do take a cut.
Yeah. And you feel it.
Irma, what about you? What was your experience?
Yeah, I've had two agents. I do think one of the benefits of having an agent is that they can harass the editors in a way that you, the author, can't. So if you're submitting to Aviva or anybody else, you can't be emailing her all the time going, hey, have you looked at my manuscript yet? That will just piss them off. But the agents can do that. So they can
you know, make those submissions out to the senior editor, they know which editors are the right person to go to. So, you know, they will. There are multiple editors in a publishing house, and they will know that, okay, your book, I think this particular editor will be interested in. And then they can pressure them to... Because the thing is, all of these editors, they are so overworked and they have so many manuscripts coming to them all the time, as well as of course, as the manuscripts that they're actually... they've already signed and are working on. So they don't have a lot of time. So the agents, I think, are invaluable in just actually getting them to look at the book and decide whether they want it or not. And I do think... I think for some genres that's not so important. Like, in for some reason in children's publishing, you just don't seem to need an agent as much. Like, if you've got one, great. But the majority of children's authors I know don't have an agent. And I think there's something about those senior editors being more accessible for some reason. I don't quite know why that is, but I think with literary fiction it's really invaluable to have an agent. And... like Catherine said, it does also mean that if there's a problem that arises, like with the cover, for example, where you hate your cover and you just think it's the worst thing that you've ever seen, you've got somebody who can go in and bat for you. Yeah. But also you've got that intermediary, because sometimes an author might hate the cover, but actually it's a good cover for the book. Like, yes. They know it's going to sell well. The author doesn't... I mean, I work in publishing, so I'm working with cover design and all of those kind of things, but a lot of authors don't have that experience and knowledge. And so in those cases, the agent may actually be saying to the author, no, you need to trust your publisher. So I actually think they're really good in that sense as well. Mm. Yeah, I think it's invaluable having one if you can get one, but it is harder to get an agent in Australia than it is to get a publisher.
We should say too, and these will be in the show notes for the episode, that the Australian Society of Authors has terrific resources in terms of a list of Australian authors, Australian literary agents, sorry, who are accepting works and when they accept works. If you're not a member of ASA, you are still able to look at those resources, but I also highly recommend that you become a member of ASA.
Yeah, can I just jump in with two other resources too? One is the Australian Writers Marketplace, which is a you know, you can subscribe to it for, I think, about $30 a year, and that will list all the agents in Australia and many abroad as well, and who they represent. Mm. And that's a bit of a guide to you. Is this someone who's likely to like my work? And, you know, I really recommend that. And the British version of that is the Writers and Artists Yearbook. Mm. So they're both really helpful, because you can also go overseas for an agent.
Now, it's really important. You talked about the key thing is to write the good book first. And so I want to ask about your writing practice, for the three of you, and how that may have changed over time. One of the joys of speaking to experienced writers is to see what they were doing at the start and what they've learned along the way. So, Tim, how does your writing practice fit into your life? What works well for you? How do you get the book written?
I'll answer that. But let me say one thing. It is so hard to get an agent. So if in your cover letter, make it the best cover letter you've ever written in your life. Mm. If you spend 3 years, a year, 10 years writing a book, don't skimp on your cover letter, because that's often all they'll look at. All right? My writing practice. I work 2 days a week in the disability sector, and I write 4 days a week.
It's a joy.
I'm tired.
You're tired now.
I have two kids in primary school as well. When I started, I had a 500 word a day goal. And I'd have to, it took me an hour to write. If it took me 8 hours to write, I'd write that bloody 500 words. Doesn't seem like much, but if you can do 10,000 words a month, that's a book. Now, again, I take 2 or 3 years to write a book, but I think that I suppose, the tortoise in a way. I just incrementally going forward. I always edit every day. I start with reading what I've written the day before and I edit it. Mm. I have that word goal. Now, I had 500 has been my goal for a long time, and I think it suited me, but recently I've tried to push it up a bit. Push myself, because I'm going from science fiction, which, especially science fiction noir, that can be quite, the prose is a lot more spare, and so you have to spend a lot more time on every sentence and making it as efficient as possible. I'm writing fantasy now, which can be a lot more sprawling. Doesn't mean there's a lot of fat in the work, but it means you can you can be a bit more expansive. So I, as anyone who went to my world building workshop a couple of days ago, I have plastered around me the world on or above my desk on, and to either side of my desk, and it's got everything about the world I'm building. It's the magic system. It's the characters, how they look, expressions that they use, physical appearance, the secret they have, floral fauna, language, you name it about the world. And so I have this bloody paper blue tack to the wall, and it'll be up there for 2 or 3 years, and I'll be sick of it at some point, but it's not going down until I've done the novel. But then that's the one of the ways I immerse myself in this world, and I constantly remind myself about all the key dimensions of the world and of the character and of the plot. I was saying this it was at the world-building workshop, that novels are almost impossible to keep in your head as a writer. There's so much going on. And I think you need every tool possible to do that and to be internally consistent within your book and to remind yourself of the book that you're writing. But my approach is, in short, it's ultra-disciplined. It's every day, well, 4 days a week, I get up, I do the work, and I'm editing, I'm writing every day. I try to read every single day. I think reading is should be part of your practice as a writer, and reading beyond your own genre. I'm a science fiction writer, but I don't read much science fiction at all in a year. I read almost everything but. And I think even though there's... you'll always hear different advice from writers on what good practice is, and it's unique to that person. But the two ones I think are the golden rules are write as much as you can and read as much as you can.
I love that Rain Collins, who was here, who's an author, her latest book is called Fed to Red Birds, and she spoke the other day on a panel about that idea that there are different... writing for her looks like lots of different things. Looks like research, looks like reading, looks like walking. And that sometimes takes a while to learn in your practice that you can include those things. They are all part of the writing practice too, which I think is really important for people to know.
And that's true for me. And I didn't even really mention this. There's the walking and the thinking, and there's just the lying there and staring at the ceiling. But one of the tough things about talking about writing is there's no blueprint. No one knows what they're doing. You're kind of fumbling along, and we'll all, I'm sure, have quite different... we'll have some similarities, but I'm sure we've got very different practices as well. And it's what we've just kind of figured out, trial and error, over the years.
Trial and error. Well, for instance, on the word count, and Emma, I'll ask you whether you have a daily word count, because I know that in the audience here is the esteemed writer Pip Williams, who gave one of our most favourite pieces of advice recently on the podcast, because she's changed her daily word count to one word, which was very effective. So you can go back and listen to our interview with Pip and why that's worked for her. Emma, what about you? What does your writing practice look like?
I want to know this secret word.
You'll have to listen to the other episode.
I want that method.
Emma, what about you? And because you're also fitting in your editing work, your podcast work, what's your practice look like?
Yeah, it's a bit crazy, and children as well. So because I'm full-time freelance book editor, that takes priority. And sometimes because I'm freelance, you know, the work is just overwhelming. So I've just had 6 weeks where I literally have not been able to write. But I've just got back into it now. And ideally what I do is two times a week, just about 2 hours. So I drop the kids at school and I go to a cafe. And that's important for me because it's separate to I work from home. Mm-hmm. It's like a separate space. So I'm instantly in my creative mode. And I write for 2 hours, maybe 3 max. And that's actually ideal for me. Like when I've had weeks at somewhere like Varuna Writers' Centre, I realise that I become less effective. So just having those short bursts, I just sit down and I start banging it out. So I have a goal of writing 1,000 words in those sessions, but I often don't make it and it doesn't bother me. So sometimes I might
write 1,300 words and that's a good session. Sometimes I might write 500 words. Often I write more like 700, 800 words. But it's funny because just having that word count in my head, there's something about that that just keeps me moving forward. And then ideally I'll get a third morning in, but I actually don't want more than three mornings a week. I found then it works and it's better if they're in a row. And then the rest of the week, there's stuff that I'm not aware of that I know is just humming in the background. And so that, I suppose that plays into that idea that Rain was talking about, where there's work that's related to the writing that's not actually writing. And then again, when I come on a Monday, I like to start on a Monday and sit down, I start straight away. It's interesting, I've never thought about reading as being part of my writing practice, even though it's obviously so important to that. But I've never thought of that as like time that, because I read every single night, you know, and it is. It's so important.
That's how I end the work day. It's like 11 o'clock at night.
But I've never thought of that as being, this is actually work that I'm doing.
Oh, it's awesome.
I'm going to categorise it as that now.
I think it's really important. And Robbie Arnott spoke with Astrid Edwards for The Garret, so you can listen to this conversation at Canberra Writers Festival. And he really reminded me, he was talking about the reading as part of the work and, of a fiction writer in particular, and that we can't just fit it in the 10 minutes before you fall asleep every night. You know, it has to be part of the practice too. Catherine, what about you?
Well, firstly, just as a reader, I would say I think we read for different reasons. Yes. I think we read just for pleasure, but it's really also important to read, you know, in the territory that you're writing in, to read for research, to read for inspiration, to read for technical craft. Yes. You know, how is this person doing what they just did? Yeah. And sometimes those things merge. That lovely thing when you're halfway through, you know, a work of narrative and you think, oh, hang on, they've just completely changed voice and tense. When did that, how did they? That's that kind of stepping in and looking at it technically.
Yes.
So my writing practice is different for every book, actually. There are some things that have been consistent, and one of them is quite different from yours, Emma, in that I do go on retreats. I go on silent retreats, which is a practice I began in my very early 20s when I was on a date with a man after a breakup, and I babbled for about 3 hours about my breakup. And at the end of the date, this man gave me a card for a silent retreat and said, I think you might benefit from this. I am forever grateful to that man for so many reasons. But it did, and it became, I mean, so I do often say to people, be careful what habits you begin early on, because you can become superstitious about them. So that one, I do go, you know, with every book for a couple of periods as much as I can. And I've always done that through raising children. Just that I have some periods where I go away for as long as I can, but never really more than 2 or 3 weeks in absolute silence if I can manage it, with nuns feeding me, if I can manage that.
How much would you get done in those 2 or 3?
A lot. Yeah. A lot. But again, this is the thing, that there are the different phases of writing. So I did a workshop yesterday, and so I know there are some people here from that, so forgive me for repeating this story, but I once a year or so run an online program called Deep Immersion, which is all about this whole thing of getting out of your own way, finding your own method. How do you figure out the thing that works? Try this, try that. And at the start of the last one I did, this woman said right at the beginning, oh, I'm not creative. I'm just going to see. And I was like, okay, well, I think you probably are, because, you know, you're human and humans are creative. So at the end of this sort of 6 weeks, she'd just tried different things. And she said she'd run out of ink on 7 pens and written something like 56,000 words.
Bloody hell.
So I think I would say, one, try different things.
Yes.
See what happens. And what works one day or 1 week might not be the same thing as works, you know, a different week. And my experience is that every book, and this kills me, and I hate to say this to people, because, you know, I think joy is a really big part of the process, just pleasure. And I do try and make everything about my writing practice a pleasure. But the kind of slightly less joyous news is that, yeah, every single book, every single project, every script, you know, you're learning a new way to do it, because you have to become the writer that project needs you to be in order to write that project. you know, you're kind of being written as you are writing. And just as an aside, if you want to know what that one magic word of Pip's is, on the 25th of September, I'm sorry, Kate, I'm doing a free online conversation with Pip through the Australian Writers Mentoring Program. So, Pip, you're going to have to be able to say the one word is. So you might be able to hear, which is about craft. So she might be able to tell you what the one magic word is.
Yeah, I love that.
All want to know.
One of the things that you've raised just then was about Varuna, a residency, the idea of deep and silent retreats, of online workshops. What I'm really interested in knowing is the people or the things, whether it be prizes, mentors, residencies, that one person at a festival who gave you that one piece of advice, who or what has really helped along the way, has been really influential to you as a writer? Tim, maybe we'll start with you. Sorry.
Influential? Well, I mean, that's sort of obvious literary references. I think scaling, at the very beginning, I think scaling back my ambition and working on my craft through short stories was fundamental in making me a better writer and quickly, because the cycle of rejection and submission and critique for short stories is so much faster. So that was, I think that, because I came to writing prose in my 30s, which is not late, but it's for me, but I mean, when I talk to writers and they're all writing stories when they're 12 years old, I'm like, oh, bloody hell. So it supercharged my writing craft. I think with 36 Streets, I was really fortunate. I think we were talking about this. I did it as a PhD. So I did a creative writing PhD, and I got a scholarship. And it's kind of the only way left in this country where you can get paid to think and write. Mm. So I had that space. I had 3 years. I did the thesis as well, but I was working on the book. And subsequently, I suppose, talking about the way it shaped my approach is that I treat every book kind of like a PhD, with the amount of research I put in and the amount of time that it takes me to write. I do in-depth research for everyone. I have shelves put aside in my office, just the books I'm going to read for this particular novel. But in terms of, I don't know if there's one, I've never really had a mentor as such, but I do think that I watch interviews with writers all the time on YouTube, and I'm always fascinated by their approach to the process and their process for writing. And sometimes I'll steal a really cool idea. But for the most part, I stick to reading as much as I can and writing as much as I can. Mm. That's really informed. Mm. And it's the obvious stuff you hear a lot, but it's true. Like, write the book you want to read. Mm. Don't worry about markets. Don't second guess an audience. Because you'll always be behind the curve anyway, because traditional publishing is so slow. Write stuff you love, 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 and it'll come out. All that passion for your work will come out in the text. You get second-guessed enough in this business. Don't second-guess yourself. Just do the thing you love, you know. Mm. I think that'd be it.
Love it. Irma, what about you? Things that have helped, or people who have helped along the way, significant ones?
I feel so grateful to the people who supported me when I was starting out, before I had published anything even. Mm. And I feel like they have helped me immeasurably on my, you know, way. So when I was studying creative writing in second year, my tutor was Craig Cormick, who actually did the first two seasons of the Secrets from the Green Room podcast with me, a dear friend of mine. But that was when I first met him. And after one of the classes, he said to me, oh, can you stay back? And I was like, oh, God, what? I've written something terrible, because we were just getting this piece back. And he said to me, I just want to let you know that I've been really hard on you in marking that short story, because I think you've really got something. And
it was such a pivotal, I didn't even think he'd been hard on me, so that was nice. And then he, you know, really supported me from that point onwards. Another writer who I mentioned before, John Clancy, who I feel like he just kind of took me on and mentored me without there being any kind of official, like, word that that's what we were doing, but just really, so, and still does, really support me and believe in me. And I think just having some of those people very early on who believe that you've got something and who give their time to you for no reason, like they've got no reason to do that other than that they think you've got something. And that has been amazing. And it's something that I've always tried to do as well, to mentor other writers as they're emerging as well. I just think it's so important.
And I think you do that as well through the Secrets from the Green Room podcast. That's one of, you know, we often talk about good industry citizenship on the podcast, and I think that absolutely goes into that as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, it means we get to explore all the kinds of things that we're talking about today that you don't necessarily know about when you're just starting. I mean, I didn't know anything, you know, and those people really helped me in all sorts of... So in knowledge of the industry... also in that, what we were talking about before, like introducing you to people.
Yes.
That makes such a difference. But then also in the writing itself, which is, of course, the firstly most important thing. Yeah.
Catherine, for you, again, this is two hats for you.
So many.
You've had people, but also this is at the centre of what your mentoring program does too.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. But I love, Emma, that you said, I'm so grateful. Mm. You know, because I think that gratitude is such a is so important, basically, and I think it opens something up. It opens a generosity up. And I would say, my God, you know, just too many. We could spend 3 hours with me just...
Yeah.
But in that, I would say in, yeah, many, many people opened doors for me or backed me or gave me a sense of myself as a writer. When I was very young, I'd been an actor and I wrote a play, in a gap between performance contracts, and I put on this play with, you know, formed a co-op with a jazz trio that I sang with at the time and a couple of other actors and a choreographer. And at the end of that play, a theatre director who I'd worked with phoned me the next day and said, you know, I want you to come and be a playwright in residence for it. And it was the State Theatre Company of Western Australia, so it was a big company. As an aside, I put the phone down and said to my housemate, who was also an actor, Graham thinks I'm a terrible actor. And she said, what did he actually say? I said, he asked me to be a playwright. He didn't give me a job as an actor. So, which is an interesting one in itself, that kind of our willingness to, like, look for what's the negative in here? What can I find? Mm. So he was definitely, you know, he took an absolute punt on me as a playwright. And that gave me a sense of learning craft on the job, as it were. Then I did an MA in Sheffield with the Caribbean poet E.A. Markham. So I was a poet at the time. And... He effectively mentored me. I was basically, there were two of us doing poetry, and he would come and spend these sort of individual sessions. So like you, Emma, I loved his, he was very fierce and very exacting, and for me that was superb. And then the third one is I was really lucky enough to, very early on, at the start of my publishing career, well, at the start of my kind of writing prose career, I met a very dear friend, the British writer Jill Dawson. And when my first book came out, I met the Canadian writer Kate Pullinger, and we were sort of doing lots of events together. And those two writers and another writer, the British writer Louise Doughty, kind of have become a little, you know, let's call it a support group. So, of course, now I live in Australia, they're all still in the UK, but we are constantly sort of checking in with each other on a sort of, you know, am I off kilter here? Yeah. Oh, I'm really in that sort of really tedious thinkity-thinkity stage of the book. I'm really bored with it, you know, but you always say that at this stage. So I would say finding, it's not just having industry gatekeepers backing you. Yeah. Finding people and noticing people who are your allies. Mm. So, I mean, I sometimes, when I'm, you know, teaching groups, ask people to just sit and take some time to list who are my allies? Mm. And by that I mean, who are the people who remind me of my creativity? Who are the people who value my writing? Not just who can open the door for me, you know? Yeah.
Such good advice. I'm deeply aware that we're running out of time and I have 50,000 questions left, but I want to give some time for you to ask questions. There are three questions I have to ask, so I'm going to think about your questions and I'll come to you in a minute. The first one I want to do, and you're going to have to do this in 1 minute each, less if you can, a little bit as a modelling exercise for the authors in the audience. I would like you to imagine that you are a bookseller and you're pitching your book that is on the table here. Can you please pitch it to us, Emma? I can see Tim's body language, so I'm going to go with you first, Emma. Emma, can you please pitch us The Breaking?
Okay. It is about elephants, travel, and finding your way. So it's about Hannah, young woman who arrives in Thailand. She's disorientated. She's out of her depth. She meets Devon, this feisty, bold, confident woman who's been living there and teaching English. And Devon sweeps her into her orbit, and together they get involved with rescuing elephants from the tourism industry. And ultimately, they have to decide how far they will go to save a life.
Oh,
boom.
Smash it. Okay. Catherine Heyman, sell us Fury, please.
I feel like reading my blurb.
I'm just going to say this is the story of a year. I'm going to say it as me, not as the bookseller.
Yes, please do.
This is the story of a year in my life after a traumatic sexual assault trial. At the end of a series of traumas from a life that was informed by extreme poverty and many indignities. And at the end of this, of the sexual assault trial, a year in which I ran away from my life, and understanding that I needed to invent a new story for myself, a new way of being. So I ran away, became a deckhand on a fishing trawler in the Timor Sea in the worst season that the Gulf had ever known, with the most incompetent crew that the Gulf had ever known. Became a deckhand, and that year, that season, that wild, disastrous season on board the Ocean Thief, that and a lifetime of reading transformed my life.
Oh. Oh, shit, I should have gone first.
Okay, Tim, your turn.
I hate that question.
I pitched it as, oh, what am I, the bookseller? It's Ghost in the Shell meets Apocalypse Now. Vietnam, the year 2100, cyberpunk. There's gangsters, gunfights, martial arts, a military occupation, mind-bending technology weaponized for social control. But at the heart of it all, our damaged protagonist, Lin Ti Vu, trying to solve a murder at the heart of a global conspiracy. Like good science fiction, it is, I hope, a page-turner, but like the very best science fiction, it touches on deeper themes of colonialism, of identity, and of the dehumanizing impact of technology.
Oh, very good. Okay, let's go to some questions. I can see first hand up over here. Thank you.
My question is about how do you know when you've gone wrong in a project, when you're deep in, when you've made a not a small choice, but a major wrong choice? How do you know, and what do you do to kind of course correct?
Great question.
Yeah, I with The Breaking, it's three parts, and the last part, I brought it back to Australia and it was wrong. When I wrote the first two parts, I had this energy the whole time I was writing, like it was just zinging. And then it just got a little bit flat in the third part. And I knew that I had to cut that whole third part, which was about 25,000 words or something. And John Clancy actually said to me, well, what would happen if you kept it in Thailand? And I started rewriting, and immediately that energy came back, and I knew that that was, and so the book ended in a completely different place. I feel like the characters, it's like that sliding doors where they went two different ways, but it can be hard. And also because of the way I write and I edit as I write. I think it's just my nature as an editor. So those words were polished words. They weren't just dashed off words. But sometimes you have to make the really hard decisions. And I try and trick myself by cutting and pasting it into another document. Like, yes. Oh, it's still there. I can still use it if I want. Yeah. You know, one day I might repurpose it into something else, and I never, ever have. But it does trick me into being able to let go of those words. I find that really useful.
So I would, can I jump in there? I would really ask yourself, is this a structural problem or is it deeper than a structural problem? Because structure is just technical. You can just, exactly as Emma said, you can move things around. You can, you know, take things away and just put them in a holding safe. So first of all, really try and ask yourself, is this structural? If it's deeper than structural, you need to go back to that zing, go back to that energy, and try to retrace your steps. Try to go back right to that place where you first really fizzed with this idea, whatever that fizzing looks like for you. And then you might be able to remap your way. It's a really deep question, but the first thing I would say is figure out, is it structural? Is it character? Is there something really that's actually, this is the hard thing, and it's all about telling the truth to yourself. Is it actually something fundamental in this project, in the character, in the voice that's not working? Again, if it's voice, you can adjust that. If there's something fundamental in the project and it's not just a wrong choice, then you might need to start unpacking things. But you need to, you know that it's never a disaster. It's just an opportunity to rethink, relearn, and make this thing the thing that only you can write.
I think, can I? I think you do develop a pretty good sense after a while as a writer. It's one of the skills I think you have to develop is where you back yourself and where you accept that you need to make some changes. But I think you also have to have a couple of people you really trust who've got pretty good judgment. And it might be an agent or it might be an editor. But my wife is a big supporter of me and she reads all my bloody stories. She or occasionally an editor will give me advice that hurts and that I resent and that I get cranky about. But 24 hours later, often I'm like, God damn, they were right.
But you sort of knew when she said it, didn't you? I see that when I'm working closely with people that they're always like, I hate that.
I don't know. I go through the five stages of grief in about 24 hours. Denial, anger, bargaining. Yeah. But I think you do, like I said, trust your own. At some point in time, you trust your own judgment and back yourself as a writer, but you do need a couple of people whose judgment you also really, really trust. I don't know how I would have gone without that. Yeah.
Excellent. Another question I can see. Yes, one down here. It's Margaret Hickey, author.
Famous writer.
I've loved this so much. Thank you. Catherine, I'm so interested in when you said that if you want overseas rights for your book, you must have an agent. I'm, asking for a friend.
Love your friend's work. Look, I don't know. There may be exceptions to that. There are exceptions to this, actually. There are some Australian publishers, Text, for instance, and Affirm, I think, are really great at this too, where you sell your world rights to them and they sell them on. And they do that really well, actually. So, that would be the caveat to that. There are definitely some Australian publishers, I was going to say generally the smaller presses. Allen and Unwin used to have a really good international rights. I'm going to stop talking there because I think I can't really speak to that. Smaller presses tend to be particularly good at selling those international rights on. So even that's not a given. It's helpful. It's not crucial, really. Yeah.
Excellent question, Margaret. Margaret will be on next in this space with Jason Stager and Shelley Burr, of course, after we finish this session. Another question for our panel. I have a million more if you don't. Okay, I'm going to go to the question that we always ask. You can come back. I'll come back to you on the First Time podcast, which is a piece of advice either that you were given or that you continue to give that you think has been the most useful for your career as a writer. I'm going to go to Irma because you're giving me eye contact.
not looking away. Well, this kind of taps into something Tim was saying earlier, and Charlotte Wood talks about this a lot, about writing where the heat is.
Yes.
And I just think, you know, as Tim was saying before, you've got to write what you feel strongly about, not thinking about, oh, no one's going to like this, or, you know, there's no market for this. You have to write where that heat is. And also things that scare you as well. When something really scares you, to just go in hard and in deep. And I think in doing that, not thinking about, it's really useful to not think about the market or a publisher or that your mum's going to read the book or whatever it might be, right? That's scary. I'm writing a book at the moment. There's a lot of sex in it. I'm not thinking about my parents at all. But yeah, writing where that heat is, I think that's really crucial.
I love that idea too. I once heard Helen Garner talking about the fact that, you know, you write with the door closed. So you go into the heat, you go into the fear, and no one's going to rip that manuscript off your desk or off your laptop and take it away without, you know, your pass over it. So write the hard stuff, write that heat first.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent advice. Tim.
Oh, look, I think I've kind of... The best advice I've already talked about a couple of times, write as much as you can, read as much as you can, write what you're passionate about. I think that I haven't said this, aim high. Aim for the highest of the high, and by that I mean your short story, your novel, go for the biggest number one agent, go for the best market possible. You'll probably get rejected, but that's not the point. Don't sell yourself short. So I always aimed the highest, always, with my work, with my short stories, and then when I was trying to get published, knowing that what it's like for science fiction writers, going abroad, trying to get either a New York or a UK agent. I think, but simultaneously, accept that you will be rejected, and you'll be rejected most of the time, and that is part of the business. I've published maybe 25 or 30 short stories. I've had more than 300 rejections. I've published 2 books. I've got 3 more coming out, but I've had, I don't know how many rejections for them, 50 or 60. So I think simultaneously be as ambitious as you can for your work, but also steel yourself for the wave of rejections that will be coming.
Excellent. Catherine.
So many things that I want to say, but I'm really aware of time. So I would say, first of all, separate out your the private bubble, which is the golden, you know, it's just coming from me, and the craft. And I'm just thinking about that golden bubble. Number one, harness your desire. So really own why you want to do this and allow yourself to meditate on that. Desire, that drives everything. Number two, honor conflict. When something is hard in the writing, it's often where the diamonds are. It's just tension. So honor that both as a writer and in the process. Number three, actually slightly contradicting what you're saying, Tim, but just thinking about the private space, the bit where the door's closed, lower the bar. So when you find yourself stuck, you know, with a kind of, well, I just, the tendency is to go, well, that's okay. If I catch up by writing 10,000 words a day, I'll be back on track with this goal that I've set for myself because I'm running a marathon. No, you're not. You are doing what is innately human, what is the most profoundly yourself thing you can do, which is put the thing on paper, make your mark. So you're not there to please anyone. You're there to tell the truth. So drop it down. This is making me stuck. Maybe I just do 200 words a day. Maybe I do 100 words a day. Maybe I do, you know, the Pip Williams 1 word a day. Whatever that figure is, or the time, and create a ritual that helps you create that bubble. And number five, find your tribe. Mm-hmm. You know, whether that's two buddies, whether that's a writing mentor, whether that's, you know, people that you run into at festivals, find your allies.
Such good advice. The final question that we always finish on the podcast is a book recommendation. And I'll give you the insight into why we do this is because part of that idea of being a good industry citizen is to shout out, is to hold open doors, is to make that community. So on that note, I'm going to ask each of you to finish by giving us a recommendation of a debut book, anytime, any genre. Emma, I'm going for you again because you're so good at eye contact.
Well, I feel like this author doesn't need a shout out because it's Helen Garner and we all love Helen Garner. But Monkey Grip was such a pivotal book for me. I read it when I was studying creative writing at uni and I don't know, it just blew my mind. I was like, oh, this is what fiction can be. I just, every sentence and word, I mean, she crafts her sentences so beautifully. And it was just, I don't know, it was just a revelation for me. It just changed something for me. And I don't really reread books because I feel like there's so many books and I always have piles of books in my house that I'm struggling to get through. So, but I've read Monkey Grip 3 times at different times in my life and each time it's given me something different. So yeah,
I love that.
That's what I'm going with.
And you can listen to my conversation with Helen where we talk about her publishing journey for Monkey Grip.
Oh my God,
where she was
amazing
when she found out that she was getting published for that. You can listen to that on the podcast. Tim.
I'm going to cheat and give you 2 debuts.
That's okay.
this is from what I've read this year. A book that I read this year by a New Zealand author called Gideon the Ninth. It's described as her debut novel, Lesbian Necromancers on a Gothic Spaceship.
Amazing.
Now, good pick. Not normally my wheelhouse, but really good. Really good. And she got Tamsin Muir is her name, a New Zealand author, and she's done really well from that. She's written a trilogy since. 4.5 stars, that's pretty good.
Excellent.
But the debut I loved, and this is kind of cheating, this person is not alive, so they don't need a shout out, but oh my God, what a debut. Watership Down.
Oh.
I just read that for the first time this year. Oh my God, that's an extraordinary novel, moving, immaculate world building, deep, dark themes in it. I don't know why it took me so long to get to. It's been on my shelf forever, but that's what a debut. Watership Down.
I have to give a shout out to my dad, who's in the audience, for introducing us to that very early Watership Down, which I really
appreciate. Oh my God, they scared the bejesus out of me as a kid.
Love
it. It's just beautiful, and it was very moving. Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you. Great recommendations. And to finish, Catherine.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I'd really briefly want to say is that a lot of books that we think of as debuts are not always debuts. And I think that's really important because it can put, you know, Pip Williams, sorry to keep, because apparently she's in the audience. you know, the Dictionary of Lost Words often gets spoken of as her debut. Of course, it's not. She'd done a couple of other non-fiction books before. So, you know, often the thing, Mark Haddon, I mentioned, Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, that was not his debut. He'd written many other books. So I think I just want to acknowledge that, you know, you can have a few things in the drawer.
Yeah.
And your debut might not be the first book you wrote. But that said, I'm going to put a plug for the writer who won the Heyman Mentorship Award, which is a mentorship award I run in partnership with UQP and HarperCollins Alternating. And the person who won it the first year was a writer called Kirsty Jagger, whose novel was published just a couple of months ago with UQP. It's called Rose Ghetto. It's a really important novel because it speaks of an Australia that we're not very comfortable inhabiting, which is the Australia of real poverty, of both education, intellect, opportunity, culture, and economics, which makes it sound grim, but Kirsty writes this novel in the voice of this ebullient, delicious child who becomes this remarkable young adult. I can barely talk about it without tearing up. It's Rose Ghetto. It's a beautiful, beautiful novel with a beautiful voice, and it's important for Australians to read. If you know someone who grew up in a housing estate, you should read it because it will help you understand them. If you grew up in a housing estate or in poverty, you should read it because it centres your story in a way that I don't think is done very often in the literary world of Australia, which is very, very middle class. And if you don't know anyone who grew up in that world, then you have to read Rose Ghetto. Mm.
Wonderful recommendations. Can you please thank our extraordinary panel, Catherine Heyman, Irma Gold and Tim Napper. These authors will all be out in the library foyer signing books. There's plenty of books at the bookshop. If you would like to stay in here or pop back in, you'll be listening to Jason Steger at 11:30 talking to Margaret Hickey in the front row and Shelley Burr about crime fiction. I'll be back in here this afternoon at 1 p.m. talking about The Hummingbird Effect with Paul Delgano. Enjoy the rest of your festival.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.